Welcome back to Emerge. This time on the show, I'm joined by Rob McNamara. Rob is a leading expert in the field of adult developmental psychology and practice, and he has a long history of meditative practice. And so he's super deep in a lot of different aspects of adult and human development. And he's also worked with Robert Keegan, who I've had on the show previously, extensively. So he's like super deep in both the theoretics and the practice of what it means to become what he calls an elegant self, a really sophisticated human being who's capable of managing and responding to complexity and challenging situations. I've been a huge fan of Rob's work for many years. And in this conversation, it's quite special. I spoke with him on the heels of a conversation that I had with Zach Stein about ensoulment. And so that was very alive in me as I engaged with Rob in this conversation. And it was an awesome opportunity to lift up a, I think, generally underappreciated aspect of human development. And in particular, I think a highly underappreciated aspect of human development when it comes to answering this question of who do we need to become in this time of planetary crisis, in this time between worlds. And so we really open that up, look at it closely. I think we learn some really profound things that are critical for us to understand in our own transformational work, as well as for designing education and training opportunities for others. Now, it should be said that this conversation was recorded about a year ago during COVID, during the height of COVID. And so, it's old in that way, but fortunately, the content that we discuss is, I think, quite timeless. So with all that being said, please enjoy this episode of Emerge with Rob McNamara. Emerge is brought to you by the Monastic Academy for the Preservation of Life on Earth, also known as MAPLE. MAPLE is where I live, it's where I train, and it's where I teach. And there are a few offerings that I want to bring to your attention. The first is that we are running the fourth cohort of our online course that we call MAPLE Fundamentals. This course is an introduction to the MAPLE ecology of practices, and it includes training in meditation, emotional processing, circling, and peer coaching. And it's a cohort-based training, so it all happens in the context of a small and supportive community. The next cohort of MAPLE Fundamentals will be starting August 8th, and I'd love for you to join. It's a great opportunity, and each cohort gets better and better. This will be the fourth. The second offering is that this September, from September 10th to 19th, MAPLE will be once again offering a vision quest at our center in Vermont. A vision quest is an opportunity to spend time in solitude with the natural world, praying for a vision. I had the great good fortune to participate in the very first vision quest that MAPLE had, about maybe 5-6 years ago. And it was one of the most beautiful and transformative experiences of my life. If you're able to make it to Vermont in September, I really cannot recommend this retreat, this experience, more highly. The teacher of the Vision Quest is Darren Silver, and Darren has actually been a previous guest on the show. So if you want to get a sense of the flavor of his teachings, you can listen to that episode. For both of these offerings, you can look at the show notes, show description, to find links to both the online course and the event page for the Vision Quest. So, yeah, I mean, last time we talked was maybe 3.5-4 months ago, I think, and that was before coronavirus really came in earnest to America, and it was also before I sat a 75-day retreat. That was where I was for most of most of this. And I'm inclined to just explore the topics we talked about exploring back then. I've subsequent to getting off retreat, sort of tried to resync up with the collective and sense into whether the inquiry I was on is still as relevant. And really, it's after speaking with Zach Stein, just released an episode with him, have come back to, I kind of wobbled in that inquiry a bit, but now feel like actually it's even more relevant than it was before. And, you know, like you say, that your response to the pandemic has been to practice. I think there's a, well, I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. And, yeah, so that's kind of where I'm at with the, with our conversation. Although I know I've, there are some folks who I was planning on having a conversation with and they didn't feel comfortable just jumping into the same inquiry. They felt like the plates had shifted under them and they didn't know if it was appropriate. So I guess I want to check in with you about all that before we really dive in.
Well, the question that I have from our last conversation is, you know, who do we need to become to navigate this planetary meta crisis?
That's right.
And so when I revisited that, I was like, well, yeah, that is the question. Yeah. So I feel, I think part lucky, just in terms of devoting my life to the study of and the practice of human transformation, and education and development. So when we kind of run into these incredible challenges that fundamentally require us to change, I feel like, okay, I've been on the right path. And I'm also suspicious of that, you know, like, my hammer is what's needed, you know, and very curious about my biases around what's needed that preserve Rob in the face of what's likely, you know, a planetary shift. And that, you know, I likely need to go first. And interestingly, I feel like I've been in a revolutionary kind of enfoldment of my understanding of development and transformation. And so certainly, like, I think if you and I talked a couple of years ago or maybe 3 years ago, it, like, that would have been a very different conversation than, than what we can talk about today. So, some things has hold of me and is doing with me as it pleases, apparently.
So let's start there. Let's just start there. So can you share more about what this revolutionary enfoldment is doing to you? What you say it has you, what does it have you doing or have you shifting towards? And mm-hmm. what is it? What are you shifting away from? Maybe give a
Yeah, absolutely. I've been thinking in terms of new vectors of development, and the developmental trajectory that's held my attention and engagement for many decades has been that of more traditional hierarchical complexity. So very generically, just transcend and include. And it kind of a calling that we need to be able to both hold and embrace and operate with greater complexity. And I still firmly believe that that is largely true. There's just incredible challenges with cultivating the levels of complexity that are acquired. So that would be kind of one vector. The other that has kind of been reformulating my thinking is what I've been calling, just calling. You know, what is Rob's calling? What is Daniel's calling? What's our calling? Zach's been, you know, Stein's thought leadership and mentorship has been really pivotal in terms of helping to mature this part of myself. And so some of the ways that I'm thinking about it is not so much subject-object differentiation or the kind of the construction of more complex skills, but a capacity of us to go in the opposite direction in some ways, instead of moving from being had by something, being subject to something, to now having it as an object that I can operate on. There's a different vector of development that goes from object to subject immersion. And not in an unconscious embeddedness in it, but a conscious, courageous sacrifice of identity and self into our callings. And that's not, that's just a different vector as I'm talking about it. And as I'm kind of guiding leaders and clients and even organizational change efforts, how do we do that together? And not so much just stacking more complexity, but how do we immerse ourselves more wholeheartedly into the callings that are most meaningful to us? And so that's kind of a second vector of development that is just changing me. And of course, my kind of cognitive language skills to talk about this are, I think maybe the past 2-3 years, as I noted earlier, but this thing's had me, and perhaps it's had us from the beginning. And yet, I think when we look at the challenges of life and death individually, as well as collectively, we are pressed into these questions about what are we really called to do and who are we meant to become? And that's not about bigger perspectives, more possibilities, operating on greater complexity. It's about trimming away perspectives, trimming away possibilities. Mm. It's about cascading into the qualities of humanity and life and service and movement that are most fulfilling to us. So that would be one of the main other vectors that has a lot of my attention and energy. Let me hit pause and see what's got energy for you, brother.
Yeah. Well, so I definitely would love to spend a lot of time unpacking why that's relevant to the question that I think we're both asking, like, who do we need to become during this time of planetary meta crisis? But I first want to nuance or bring out the limitations of the developmental vector of achieving more and more complexity. You know, so why is that not a sufficient answer to the question of who do we need to become? Because when I look around at a lot of different folks who are kind of in the larger human development scene and adult development world, it would appear as if their answer to that question is, hey, we just need more kind of complexity. Mm-hmm. And so why is that actually not an adequate answer from your vantage point?
Yeah. And I would say that, my stance at present is a big and. Like, we definitely need more complexity. but if we don't have this and, here's some of the main problems. One, there's the growth to goodness assumption that just doesn't hold up in reality. So complexity can be incredibly powerful and ethical and just good for people's personal lives, the communities around them, the institutions that they're participating in. It can be absolutely life-changing. Unfortunately, complexity can also be evil. It can be profoundly distorted. It can be just misguided in so many ways. And so we have to really get curious about what kinds of complexity are we talking about. That's the major kind of issue, as I understand it, is that, great, like, let's get more complex. Beautiful. but, you know, some of the basic presuppositions of hierarchical complexity, development proper, as it's understood generally, is to, in some ways, transcend and include. And if we're including basic fundamental dispositions about what the human being is that are actually compounding the issues of what's causing the meta crisis. Mm. Now we're creating greater complexity of things that are going to actually accelerate and actually further potentiate the damage and the risk factors of those kind of broken biases about what we are and what we're supposed to do. Mm. And so that's the second piece is, you know, and it's related to the first, but there's a piece of, yeah, like, let's grow each other. Absolutely. But again, we've got to be really careful about what we're growing. Because if I'm, you know, for example, if my understanding of myself at a basic level is that my root contribution to society is the economic generativity that I provide. So I'm an agent of, you know, reductive human capital theory. If I'm to further complexify that, which tons of us have done, and I'm now to move from not just abstract systems, but, you know, I start working with principles that further leverage those basic biases about what I am and what I'm supposed to do. Like, that's a problem. And I think it's the problem that we're actually living, you know?
Yeah, that's like the problem.
That is the problem. And so you can't just add more complexity to that stack, if we can call that identity stack, that stack of skills. If we just add more on, we're still operating on some of those basic presuppositions. Now, is it possible that, like, we reach a certain level of abstraction, of complexity, that we can start to reformulate the basic fundamentals? And that is the case. That's what kind of really good thought leadership and really good ethical leadership does, is, you know, uses that developmental privilege, as I often talk about it, to get into the fundamentals, you know, to return to, like, you know, these very basic elemental organization of self and world. Like, can we reimagine a different way to do this? So we need, like, that complexity to do it, but the agenda to get all leaders, all people, just to kind of climb the stack, is misguided in my estimation. And it's also not, you know, given also part of what's happening globally is this question around diversity, inclusion, equity, right? And so there's something more inclusive that's required, that provides new directions that are readily available to most human beings,
right?
Not achievements that are, you know, for whatever reasons, you know, less than 1% of the population appears to achieve, you know,
right.
Like, we need to get much more creative. And what are the ways that we can, you know, diversify how we can move, you know, in ways that are really accessible to people, regardless of what stage of development they're at.
Yeah, I really couldn't agree more. And you know, I was doing research for this episode and found some YouTube videos where you were talking about how, like, to really take this, your own development, to the further reaches, it, you know, it can take a decade. You should think about it in terms of a decade of devoted work to really seriously and fundamentally up-level your complexity.
Right.
And, you know, that's, I don't know that we have a decade. And given that we don't even yet have the systems in place whereby, you know, 98% of the human population, if the statistic you just said is accurate, whereby 98% of the human population could even begin to work on that in a meaningful way, it does seem like there needs to be some other move, some kind of more available, imminent, spontaneous thing that's possible. And I guess I'm curious, like, when I think about it, I remember a conversation I had with Ronan Harrington, who was one of the organizers with Extinction Rebellion. And he was talking about how one of the opportunities they saw before them was to really promote this narrative of sacrificing for the future generations, right? The narrative about how we need to fundamentally reformat society ought to be one of, oh, this is, we're going to do this on for the sake of our children and our children's children. So we're going to bear this burden. It's actually completely noble and beautiful. And that there could be a kind of sudden shift in almost the identity of the people who are participating with that narrative. Instead of being economic agents, they're now like, you know, almost like a kind of hero, right? Sacrificing on behalf of the future. And so I'm curious, like, is that the kind of imminent shift that you're exploring with this, vector of development that has more to do with calling and being almost, it sounds like, claimed by some thing, some kind of, something's making a demand on you, I suppose, or something has you. And so what might that look like?
Mm-hmm. The short answer is totally, to pick up different images, to pick up and invoke and participate in different energetic dispositions. So the heroic is a great one. It's great limitation is that it's actually looking to perish in an ultimate significance. And so, the question of what are the heroic moves that we must do together and what are the heroic moves that we must do individually is like a really great way to come at this, the image structures that have your heroic kind of energetics and how you see yourself playing out those things and what you can conceive is just, it's unique to you, and Rob would do something else. And, but for us to collectively explore that is radically different, than the self that is ensconced in images that are organized around comfort, entitlement, security. And like, those are also, important too. And then there's like the other side of the hero is that it's the elder that is wise and enduring and is playing the long game. And it's not interested in kind of going out in a flash as the heroic structures often do, but is interested in kind of the nuanced navigation of reality such that we preserve and we can communicate tradition and legacy, and embody it. And that's where we need this kind of marriage between that which is enduring and integrative and durable and solid, trustable, with the heroics of possibility and creativity and innovation and, the full display of self in, for what we stand for, in this moment. And of course that moment passes, But yeah, that does start to get into some of the calling that is required.
Yeah. Well, so I think it'd be helpful now just to kind of take a step back and maybe make distinctions between these two vectors of development. I imagine that most folks listening are to some degree familiar with, say, Keegan's developmental model or Ken Wilber's. And if you're not, I did interview Keegan and some other folks who are kind of in that world of hierarchical complexity and development. And so it might be useful to use that as a basis to kind of contrast this other vector that we're, I think, probably going to spend most of the conversation exploring, and exploring its relevance to this larger question of who do we need to become. And so, you know, there are these, one point that you've already brought up is, like, when we talk about hierarchical complexity, we're talking 10 years to move to a new plateau or something like that. Whereas with, what do we want to call it? This, not, it's not complexity. It's calling, or how do you frame it? But one difference is that this can be more sudden. It's more, an eruption, it sounds like.
Yeah.
But I would love to kind of explore maybe some other distinctions so we can sort of call it out a bit more.
Yeah. Well, just to, if I can lay out, and we're kind of off the territory of like 40 years of research and like, like rigorous, highly nuanced scientific study. And we're like in the realm of, like, this is some of my lived experience. And, so just to kind of frame that, but a particular developmental narrative could be, in terms of our calling, we're kind of entangled with possibilities. Meaning, people at their early stages of understanding their calling, well, it could be this and it could be that. And, whoa, what about that? And, oh, you know, this could be interesting, or that could be really helpful. This is what's needed. You know, so there's this like ability for the mind and for the psyche and for the emotion to kind of move in different directions. And all of them are potentiated. Like, oh, it could be this, it could be that. And that's a certain kind of layer of maturity as it pertains to one's calling. And of course, like, if we imagine this as a funnel dropping down, we're cleaving off things, right? You know what? That is super interesting. It's totally needed. And it's actually not for me to do.
Yeah.
So I'm lopping that out. And this is a different stage of the maturation of where we start kind of lopping off things that are possibilities that could be exciting. They might be incredibly generative in all kinds of different ways, but we're intentionally starting to say no. And we're starting to kind of hone in on what has us. And that language, I think, is important because what has us marks, it's not necessarily what you're choosing, but what has chosen you.
Yeah.
And if we're still in the realm of it's what I've chosen and I'm the architect and I'm, you know, this is my thing, like, you're kind of in that second layer of, yeah, you've done some pruning, but it still belongs to your personality structures. And we're interested in getting beneath that, you know. So this kind of third layer that we're, you know, proposing here marks like an acknowledgement and recognition of, this isn't my choice. In some ways, like, this has been written into my code. It's in my DNA. It's like, I'm meant to. That's the essence of the calling. And there is a really ripening relationship to both full autonomy and sovereign choice to participate with this and surrender. Like I don't get a choice in this matter. It's like this is what's for me, you know? And that particular stage fruitions into a, like an even narrower column we can think of, where we have to start putting the cleaving continues, the lopping off of possibilities gets cut away once again. But the cut here is different in that you're cutting away and sacrificing things that are like really intimate and really significant for you. And earlier you weren't cleaving off those things. You were cleaving off like distal things, but now we're starting to play with the courage to profoundly sacrifice things that are like so significant to us in service of something that's even more significant. And sometimes that even more cannot be seen or intuited or understood until the sacrificial move has been made. And so there's often a precipice of like sacrificing into the unknown. And now we're discovered by something much more heartbreakingly meaningful and valuable to us intrinsically. And that developmental sequence is also likely our lifespans. So it's not that the calling is just more immediate and shifts, and I'll return to that because it is. But like this funneling into your calling or callings also has this like huge development trajectory. It has a lot to do with the heart's courage to make contact with what matters most. And in order to do that, you've got to be willing to die. And so, and this is where the, and just picking up the complexity stack, like if we're just stacking complexity, we're probably organizing complexity around avoiding death. And this is where more complexity just takes us in the wrong direction. No. It's about the heart's courage, not the mind's capacity for perspective taking, but the heart's courage to be singular, to be intimate with something that is like so life-giving, you know, and to, if we're not willing to die into the singularities of our existence and the endings of things, we don't get to touch this ineffable like grace and sweetness of life. And I share this kind of loose developmental trajectory in calling, because it points at one of these fundamental things that's eating the world, which is more. It's greed.
Yeah.
Just more this, more that, more this, more that, more that, like more possibility, more newness, more this. Yeah. Like the incessant intoxication with more is so unsatisfying, and it's so vacant in its significance. And so if we're going to deal with that thing, we can only deal with it if we have human beings who are tasting the fuller aspects of their life that quite literally are kept at the gateways of sacrifice. And the courage to touch that with that which you most love is like the most courageous of heart. Like that move is indescribably and ineffably beautiful, in that we start to participate with like this very rich conversation between life and death. But if we're just kind of stacking and trying to get out of things and get more, 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 we miss the secret gates of sacrifice that quite keep us from our fuller human experience. Yeah. So, just to kind of paint a little bit of how I've been making sense and also living into these things. To come back to the immediacy of how we can shift, we can think of the diversification of identity. So, I often talk about like a monolithic identity, which is what most developmental traditions kind of build up, you know, you're growing this like beautiful, robust agency that,
yeah.
And even
like
you can
the Greek god model of human development. I kind of think totally of like, yeah. I don't know if you Google image search Ken Wilber, there's like a picture of him bald and with glasses and just ripped.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you've seen that, but that's always what I think of when he goes with that kind of thing.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, totally.
Ripped Ken Wilber. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we should just be suspicious of this monolithic identity that we create.
Yeah.
Like the singularity of where you're coming from. And then of course, most forms of development are a complexification of that singularity. Mm. And so we can think of the calling as kind of carving down into your multiplicity. So instead of the monotheism that's inside of most of our Western kind of psyche, which creates that monolithic, like, this is who you are, and you can answer it in a singular way, and you enact it in a singular way. Like, we're going into a more polytheistic, like, diversification of your interiors. And a brightening and broadening of the diversification of images that animate your life force. And that's readily available. Like it's amazing, you know, like I can sit with a client and shift from one image structure, right? One archetypal pattern, one kind of energetic that's, you know, leaderful, is the captain. and that's very different from the scientist, you know, like this scientific, like, dimension of self is very different. And there's a tension, there's a creative tension between the two. And then the rebel shows up, this revolutionary part. You know, and oh, but now the mystic shows up. And oh, now the empath shows up. Like, so that's, you know, just a loose constellation. But we can start to feel that when we invoke the image of one, we can now participate more fully with those callings, you know, that are entangled in that image structure. You know, like for Rob and just personally, like when my lover image structure is enacted, it's very different than when the warrior gets activated. You know, like, and I go to battle to like protect what I most love, like watch out. And of course there's the relationship between the two, right? Yeah. And their integration, you know, we can think of as good, but not as an integration to become like one thing. It's the integration to actually build a more robust dilemma between the lover and the warrior, such that how do we kill in love? How do we protect? You know, and not go into hatred, you know, and how do we not enact things, you know? And that's very different from like the image structure that is invoked in our conversation. I feel my like there's a bunch going on right now. But like there's an element of the professor, you know, like the professor has been invoked to profess like my truth, you know, with authority and dignity and hopefully some beauty and refinement. Fingers crossed over here, you know. But those shifts are like radically available, like in the moment. And for us to start to open up to the possibility that when we pick up one energetic, one image structure, one scene, and water it and nurture it, not as like where we're setting up a permanent residence, but like I'm going to visit this like wholeheartedly for this period of time. And then I'm going to visit that other thing over there, you know? Let me hit pause. Go for it, brother.
I can imagine somebody listening and what we're talking about here is like very, very personal. Like typically you think of this kind of work as being the most personal kind of work you can really do, like diving deep into your archetypes, the depth of your psychology. And yet I think both you and I, have a sense that this is some of the most valuable work that we can be doing in order to participate skillfully in the planetary crisis. And so like, can you, before we kind of nuance this territory further, I'd love to hear a reflection of like why, like again, why is it that this is relevant? Because I can imagine people just being like, well, this is cool, but it's a nice to have, but not a need to have when shit gets real.
Yeah. Well, so the image structure is not just an intra-psychic image structure. Like quite literally the world that is illumined by what you see, how you feel, is invoking parts of you. So when I point at image structure, I'm not just pointing at like that heroic archetypal structure, right? We're also revealing the illumined reality that you are living in. And that is like the meta crisis that we also share.
can you keep picking that? I didn't quite get that connection, and I imagine that, can you just unfold that again just to make sure that that's clear?
Yeah. So we're not just doing interior work. Some of it is, but the image structure, that happens is also the reality that you're living in. The illumined world as you know it and see it and relate to quote unquote it is the image structures that are also invoking you.
You know, right, because just in this way of looking, the world comes to you as image structure.
Yeah. Yeah. The immanent domain is like a felt, embodied, illumined world that you are orienting around.
And so I think this is really important to just double click on this, that whether you're consciously participating in this kind of strata of developmental work, that image structure and image is already operating on you, or you're already being operated by it.
Yeah.
And so it's not like something you kind of choose to opt into on a weekend workshop, but instead it's something that fundamentally structures the way that you participate in, the way that you see, the way that you orient to the world.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And just to be really like blunt about it, you know, the way that a police officer approaches you with the tone of their voice is an image structure that illumines all kinds of responses. And walking in at home and being greeted by your partner that's filled with delight to see you, that's it. Very different than when you walk in and they are like livid. Like, so these intimate contours are incredibly powerful, you know, like somebody cuts you off in the car, you know, and like what, like that's an image structure that like makes up your physiological, psychological response to that, you know? So it's, you know, what we're talking about is like deeply intertwined in just the basic process of perception itself. Mm-hmm. But by doing kind of calling work, we can like invoke more intentionally different responses to the world as it's becoming known. And quite literally those shifts, you know, when I go from like a professor, like to actually abandon the energetic and the image of professor and to fully inhabit student, you know, to enter in with you in like deep inquiry, like what am I here to learn? Like that's so different, you know, which is very different than like the warrior, you know. But we start to get more range in response to whatever image structure is happening in the world. Meaning we start to get more choicefulness around which image structures do we evoke. It's no longer just the thing that gets evoked. Like, okay, like I could, you know, I could go into war mode here, you know. Ah, what if I'm supposed to fall in love with this situation? What if I'm not supposed to be in war with the coronavirus, but how do I fall in love with that? You know, all the death, all the destabilization, like, you know, that would be quite radical. How do we fall in love with this thing that's killing the people that we love? How do we do that? You know, so, and this is the thing, is that the gap between the world as it's illumined in its all glory, if we can kind of see the metacrisis or whatever dimensions of the crisis that you can see, whatever like points of suffering that have you, like doesn't matter what the scale is, but whatever has your suffering, like how can we invoke more possibility to how you respond? And how do you respond in ways that are in deep congruence with what matters most to you? And this is very intimate, and it's very, you're right, it's like the most intimate because we're talking about the reasons for your existence.
Yeah.
And, but that, this needs to become a public thing that we do together. At least that's my thing, because If we don't diversify our potential for how we can respond, like it's all too predictive in terms of what's going to happen next.
Right. Right.
And those keep compounding the problem. It's not the solution, you know?
Yeah. And when you say it needs to happen in public, what's the it that needs to happen in public?
Well, this is part of, you know, and, we can think of it as an education, and you know, like to draw people out of something, you know, this thing that has you, let's draw you out of it so that you can actually have more choice. What do you want to choose into? But it's your choice, you know, it's your sincere, wholehearted choice in. Like, we've got to start doing that collectively.
Yeah, I feel that, and for sure. Yeah.
This, the privacy and the, it's kind of behind hidden doors. And I mean that literally, like it's behind hidden doors, doors that we don't even know that are there, that these inquiries are happening. And collectively, you know, if human potential is like the largest untapped resource on the planet, if that's true, collectively, we've got to start enacting, you know, our ranges to deal with these questions, you know?
Yes.
Because death is coming for us, whether it's happening via, you know, COVID-19, or some other thing, but like death has all of us. None of us are getting out of this. And there's an unconditioned reckoning that already is working on us, which is like, what must you live for? And what ultimately matters? And like, your ends are either celebrations and or like deep grievances, like profound grief around, like, I didn't do it. I didn't risk everything for what I'm called for. And like, to, we allow like droves of human beings to die in that grief.
Yeah.
At least that's my bias.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, presumably most folks aren't passing and thinking, boy, I sure wish I got to Keegan stage five, you know, there.
Yeah, that's
some not it. Other kind of drive that's acting on them. And
yeah, totally.
So two things are occurring to me that I've kind of got illuminated by what you said. One is that you're presencing a particular set of questions, like what is most meaningful to me? What would I die for? What has a claim on me? You know, this sort of genre of questions, which I think aren't absent from our culture. Like, you can go online and read articles about how to find your life purpose, and they'll say like, well, reflect on this question. Right. And yet there's this second piece that you've been, I think, indirectly pointing to, which is almost a kind of like literacy or awareness or sensitivity to image structure and to this whole domain and arena of human experience, which frankly, I think is just completely untrained in most for most of us, for most people who grew up in American culture, for instance, I know that was never a part of my training. I've had to very intentionally begin a very lengthy process of attuning to this sort of dimension or these dimensions. And I'm curious, like, it seems like those questions that you're asking, they have potency by themselves, but they really amplify in potency when you also have this kind of sensitivity, this attunement, this capacity to explore this image space. And so I'm curious what you've discovered about, like, perhaps in your own life or in working with others, about how do we cultivate this capacity to explore and attune and sensitize to image?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think for adults, you know, and again, just developmentally proper in terms of hierarchical complexity, image appears to precede language. Right. So the fact that I can hold an image of mom in my mind while mom's not here is a prerequisite for me really being able to understand, like, M-O-M, mom. So there's that developmental sequence. The image is prior to language. And we often kind of leap into language, and then that's, you know, where so much of the complexity happens. In our ability to use language and to increasingly, you know, paint more robust abstractions. But they're quite literally built on the image structures. But it's a different domain, right? Like, it's, we can think of it as a different mode or a different domain that we're exploring. And so most people come at purpose and calling and reasons for existence with, let me formulate it with language and get really particular about the language. And most of the time it's like that it feels really good to, like, get it out there and to articulate it and to get it clear and to, like, voice it with our passion. And inevitably it becomes dead. It becomes, like, stagnant. And no matter how hard we try to keep that thing alive, it's dead. We just killed it. And so we've really, as a whole, just need to, like, hey, language is awesome. But language is inherently about us in shared communication. It's a tool, an instrument, it's a mode for us all to cohere and to create discourse. So it's generic in its DNA. Image is not. Image appears to be, like, profoundly unique. So, you know, what is, you know, as interviewer, like, you know, or I don't know what image structure has you when you're doing these conversations, or what set of images tend to come up, but, like, it, like, that's something very particular and unique to you. Mm-hmm. So kind of first step is to, like, really just acknowledge that language is brilliant. It's amazing. It's so powerful, and it can't quite tap the elemental things of what calls us from an image perspective. And then just that says, okay, I got to do something different, you know? And now we can start to look at what helps us, you know? And things like, you know, active imagination, incredibly powerful, you know? So Jung's instruction on the power of active imagination is, like, incredible. So just take an image structure that is potential, that has energy. You know, it might be a vignette, a scenario from a dream. It could be, like, this article with this picture, you know, It could be this conversation with a colleague. It could be this scenario with your children. Like, but to go back and revisit it, and not to get stuck in just a revisiting, which is usually what happens, with reflection. It's like, well, that's what happened. Well, okay. Well, what's happening now? You're back there and now something else is unfolding and you're starting to rehearse different ways of being, different ways of responding. You're starting to circle like different dimensions of yourself and enact different dimensions of yourself. Well, what happens? And like, this is happening all over the place. So if you notice it, like going into an important meeting, you've been emotionally rehearsing that in your image structures, to try to groom a positive outcome for yourself. Like, you're already doing it. An important conversation with your kid or your spouse, or, you know, same thing. Like, you're already using it. But how do you create some space to intentionally suspend language and just dive in? Because you're illuminating all kinds of things. So, I think acknowledge the limitations of language, really mark this is a different mode of functioning, and then start to explore, you know, and creating some practice containers to enter into different image structures. And as we've been talking about, there's something to be said about, I keep going into this like angry, defiant, valiant stances. It just keeps happening, you know? Like, it just keeps, okay, like, pay attention. And where must you enact that, you know, not just your image structures and your intrapsychically, but where must you do it out in the world? And then vice versa. Like, I'm always kind and super inclusive and, like, you know, very welcoming interpersonally in my social relationships. Like, that's an image structure. Like, what's going on there? You know, like, like, let's start playing with some of the things that are happening socially in the quote unquote world. Let me start playing with some different things in my interior, you know? So this kind of cross collaboration to self in relationship to world and self in relationship to self, like, just flip them. Yeah. What if I bring that kind of kindness into my own kind of self ecosystem, that warm, welcoming, like, always accepting? And what if I kind of put out into the world that, like, that radiant anger that's like saying no, and here's the fucking boundary, you know? So those kinds of things can start to really help people see and experience what has them. And again, we want to get some objectivity. We want to see it a la complexity, but it's not to then manipulate and manage. Remember, it's like, how do you get in? It's an immersion into your capacity to be fierce, to be highly protected, to be radically receptive, to surrender, you know, like, it's about the full kind of wholehearted participation with what has us, whether it's expressed publicly in kind of the social domain or privately in our own interior. But like, that would be kind of a third piece to start to play with.
Yeah, I think part of the reason I brought it up is I was just felt very struck by your presencing of kind of image structures that have you even in this conversation. And I'm aware of, we do a lot of circling here at where I live, and how rare that strata of experience enters into those spaces, right? People are often talking about feelings or what's happening in their somatic experience. Sometimes they talk about their stories. Well, that's kind of poo-pooed and circling a little bit. but it's so rare that people will presence the images that are present, or the image structures, or the archetypes. And it's just, I guess and it's just rare conversationally, I think, in general. And one thing that comes up for me is that, like, I think of some of the work I've done with image, and especially discovering my own images that are active for my, in my experience. And, you know, what my experience is that when I discover an image that's been acting on me for who knows how long, it is that which is closest to my heart, is closest to my soul. And there's something more intimate, more kind of personal, quote unquote, but also not personal at all, weirdly, about it, more, much more so than my psychological biography, much more so than whatever I'm, my emotional state is. And I hear, you know, the idea that we could do this in public is fascinating to me. And I'm also aware of how intentionally such a container would need to be created in order to honor what might be brought forth there. Like, I'm not sure exactly where I'm going with this, but I've even noticed, like, here in this community that I live in, there's only certain people that I'm willing to reveal images to, and I'm very close with everybody here. I'm curious what that brings up for you, hearing you kind of ramble a little bit.
Yeah, there is something naked about them. And it's to be known, you know. And my bias is that part of the civilizational transition that must occur is that we need more meaningful community, where it's not filled with virtue signaling and the presentation of self, but an actual intimacy with, I know Daniel. Mm. You know, Daniel knows Rob. And we see those strengths and we see those weaknesses in a much more easeful way, where there isn't this striving for perfection, but there's more of an inclusion of these life journeys that are, that have us. And that, you know, there's no overarching kind of agenda to perfect and, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think that's part of why I there's reluctance over here to often reveal image, because if you don't have that awareness that's not like that's not about perfecting the image or changing it somehow, that to present and share image, you know, somebody could take it and be like, oh, well, that's pathological, or that's, you know, you don't want that image. You want to be claimed by some other image or something like that. Right. And that to me, like, even like, as I say it, I like it, my heart kind of clenches up.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause that's the fundamental trespass, is to give somebody a image that's not their own.
Yeah. Mm.
And of course that's the ethical dilemma that we're living in. And if you look at leaders that aren't actually nourished by what they're doing, and because they're not nourished, they require to be compensated. And there's no amount of compensation that's worth it. So you always ask for more.
Mm. Mm.
And of course, because you're vacant in your leadership role, you create a vacancy in the culture. And everybody now is doing that same trade-off because they look up to you. And there's hierarchy involved. And there's, you know, and this is, you know, part of what I'm up to in terms of leadership development, is how do we write this in such a way where leaders are plugging into what matters most to them so they can be catalytic agents that are deeply ethically aligned with what's good, not just for organizational performance, but for the well-being and the robustness of their teams and their culture and their organizational capacity to generate value. It's great for business, but it's more significant for, you know, growing a different kind of human being year in, year out through work. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it is worth saying that my kind of sense of it is that these structures, which we can allow to have a claim over us, there is some kind of deep ethic, almost in kind of Daniel Schmachtenberg, there's a kind of omni-win dynamic within them. Like, as we give our lives to them, they're trustworthy.
Right. Yeah. Well, and the image structure is not a exhaustible resource. So your heroic enactments don't necessarily take away from mine. And like, there's no absence of it. Like, the capacity for the mind to imagine an image appears to be more or less infinite. And when you get to enact your greater uniqueness, it doesn't take away from mine, you know. So we really solve some of those generator functions around, you know, rivalrous dynamics by publicly situating our relationships around these things that are infinite, you know. And then, of course, what do you and I, like, what we could do together is closely approaches an infinite possibility in the realm of image structure.
Yeah.
You know, now the actual resources are much more finite, and, you know, but we'll be so much better with the equitable distribution of resources when we're tapped into our, you know, essential infinite resource to diversify our uniqueness. And if our incessant drive for more, which is a function of liberation, the fact that you've already let go of what you have and you're on to the next thing, that is the basic activity of liberation. But if it's focused in a way that's actually good for the human psyche and our ecosystems, like, now we've got a recipe for some things that are legitimate answers to the meta crisis that we're living in, at least in my estimation, at least some of the big ones, where we don't necessarily need to become rivalrous and, you know, focusing our inherent liberative tendency towards more to grapple about these finite resources, that there's just, you know,
yes,
if I take this much, there's just not enough for the billions of people on the planet, you know, and that's the kind of situation that we're in, you know, where you've got inequities that are, like, people can't even fathom the difference between, you know, somebody's net worth ballooning 20 billion. Like, we say it, but nobody can really fathom that, you know.
Yeah.
That happened over the course of how long?
You know. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of, you know, some people talk about, like, you're probably familiar with this, like, the finite infinite game metaphor.
Yeah.
And I love thinking about it in these terms, whereby, you know, right now we're we're kind of taking a finite material resource base and trying to put our pathos, our infinite drive for more, into that, which is obviously self-terminating. But if we could somehow switch the arena of our pathos to this, you know, soul, this soul-making drive, or this kind of space, then, I mean, it's game on.
Forever. Exactly. Right. Yeah. Huh.
Well, and so I guess part of what I'm curious about too is, like, so I look at what happened, at least from my perspective, and I'm not, like, you know, that much of an expert, but I'm a kind of interested layperson in the field of adult development, where people kind of got, like, tuned into this. They started having public conversations about it. People started writing books, and then that started to filter down into, you know, coaching practices. And now there are, like, apps that can help you to develop and things like that. And I suppose I'm curious, like, what's the leverage point of taking this arena of development, or this sort of logic of development, or whatever, and opening it up such that it has, so more people have access to it, so that it becomes a kind of broader cultural literacy, and so that it can have an impact, instead of, I understand that, like, putting it in the hands of leaders is one way that it can have a big impact, but I guess I'm curious, like, what are other ways that you see that are opportunities as you've been kind of discovering and exploring the space?
Yeah, I mean, I think the realm of coaching and leadership, which is where I spend a lot of my learning cycles, are huge. Getting this into psychology departments so that we can liberate psychology from pathos. You know, this is, you know, Maslow's drive, like, what does it mean to really be healthy? we might want to study that. And so helping Western psychology in particular free itself from just the study of what's wrong is, you know, something that we need to kind of further advance. So those are kind of low hanging fruit. And then when we kind of cascade out, there is something about, you know, there's new conversations about, you know, the developmental organization, like work that is inherently designed and architected to help grow people. And of course, like, how do we do that from an OD perspective to help organizations shift out of the paradigms that they're operating in to ones that are much more generative? And, like, if you do that, you will retain your employees, you know, you will have, like, fiercely creative engines inside your teams that, you know, is going to be hugely advantageous, you know, as opposed to, like, the 70% disengaged workforce that most people are grappling with, if not 80-90%, you know. So there's workforce, and I want to speak to education, but go ahead, brother.
It strikes me that, like, you know, there's a lot of work, and I've read some of it, you know, Keegan's DDO stuff. And
yeah, totally.
There's a lot more that really focuses on complexity development. But yeah. I'm just starting to imagine what it would look like to explore this realm that we've been discussing in the context of an organization, like, and how much less palatable that would be to the mainstream culture, you know, embodying, I suppose, different archetypes and really exploring and sharing images that are active for you in relationship with people. I mean, that would be rad. That would be amazing to see.
That's my, I mean, it's happening. Like, I, just on Friday, I was talking with one of my colleagues, and Gabe Wilson. I don't know if you know him. He'd be another good conversation. We're talking about this potential project with a big global organization, super rich, frothy with potential. And we're talking about stuff like this. But you know, I hopped on the call and I said, all right, well, here's my thought. Like, if this is the last thing we get to do together before we die, like, what are we going to do? And like, I mean, I tear up just now saying it. That's the kind of work that I want to be doing. And I think it's the kind of work that if you're sincere, about your life, you actually want that too. You want to have that conversation with the people that you're working with. And you want to be working with people who you love, you know? And I think it's right there. Like, the shift is like so right there, and it's very simple. And that's a big question that I'm asking Gabe, right? But we've been training together and practicing together and working together for years and years and years. It's just, that's the normal thing that we do, you know? And like, for a manager to just come and say, what's most enlivening for you? What are you most excited about? Where do you really want to go? Like, those questions start to get at what we're talking about. And the deeper that relationship becomes, the more sincere I communicate my foreignness to you. Not, you know, the more I kind of shift the relationship out of like, I'm just here to kind of use you to execute my aims. But actually, I'm here to get curious about, what do you really want to do? Where does your creative aliveness flow? Like, what are you most inspired by? Knowing that we need to get there, what enliven, you know, like, it's right there. You know, it's right there. And I think it's so, it can be really accessible. And we can start to do it in ways that are sustainable, you know? Got me rambling, as I often say.
Well, I think it's really, I mean, that's, for me, that's what I'm super curious about too, is like, so I live here at the Monastic Academy, and one of my curiosities is, how do we, or how do I start to ground some of these frames and practices and perspectives into the lived life here in the community? It's like, what do we do together to amplify this aspect of our development?
Yeah. And that's a, like, again, a beautiful question. And what is illuminating those answers, you know? You know, like, it's something about problem solving and work and advancing thing. Like, there's an inherent calling into that domain. And then there's the pleasure of being alive. There's the joy. There's things like ecstasy that inherently call us, you know? So there's play. And there's image structures that get evoked around play, you know? And both of those are like, they're right there. Like, they're right there. And of course,
Totally. That's what it feels like too. It feels like I'm like, I feel like there's just some kind of veil I have to like peek behind, and then it's just right here. It's like, there's some kind of very low impact push or something, or structure that's very elegant and very that enables this sort of thing. And so that's an open curiosity for me. I mean, it's just, I guess, sharing my process. Yeah.
And I think the things that have us, and there's usually an experience of kind of foolishness. because they're so obvious. They're so like they've always had us. And we're often looking like for some like hard to find, and it is hard to find because of its obliviousness. It's just so obvious that, you know, like my name, Robert, means bright counselor, which of course took me like decades to figure out. Like I had no idea. And then my sister was like, Rob, you do know what your name means. And I'm like, no, what does Robert mean? She's like, bright counselor, dude.
Yeah, she's like, you know, bro, come on.
So that thing has me, you know, like, and it's, there's a sense of like, duh, like the, like wisdom and foolishness are totally intertwined, you know? But there's like such relief. Oh yeah. Like I am meant to be in these kind of conversations with people. I'm like architected at the most fundamental levels to like sit next to people and face that which is most significant.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I didn't know it conceptually. It's not an object, but I keep enacting that.
Yeah.
And then people come to me. You know, this is I'm like back in my history right now, like high school, you know. That's what my friends are like just coming to me. My best friend's girlfriend's coming to me. like it's this thing. People are just approaching me because they got to have their McNamara conversation. They can't get it anywhere else. And, you know, so just to kind of steer people towards like, ask people, you know, like if you're going to try to figure this out yourself, like it's going to take you longer. But if you ask the people that have been through, you know, been with you throughout your life, like, what was I doing? You know, what was I like? And then it starts to become more obvious. And those are keys. Those are like, all right, like if you're supposed to put that on the altar and either worship it or sacrifice it, like how do you do that? You know? Anyway.
Beautiful. Well, so I want to honor the time we had scheduled, which we're already a little bit over, but I also want to I like to ask at the end of a conversation like this, you know, if there's anything else that occurs to you, you know, maybe that you didn't get a chance to say, or that you just feel called to say now, before we close it down.
Well, yeah, I just want to give a little bit of a nod that we're talking about a revolutionary injunction for education. Instead of filling people with ideas and concepts, what if our education can be organized and leaning towards people's callings intentionally investing in that is, I think it's an important thing to mark. And then the two other realms that I think this needs to be activated in is an intimate relationship. And I'm working on a book on that. So I'm not sure when that's going to be complete, but I'm working on it. But intimate relationship, you know, like why are people together? And to answer that question differently, and to intertwine the reasons for our coupling and partnership, to entangle it into our reasons for existence is like so needed. And if we can do that at scale, if we can do that together, to just come together in our intimacies and our partnerships, like that literally is going to be ushering the next generation of human beings. And so like, that's something that, you know, I'm curiously like peering at my 3-year-old, my 6-year-old, like, who are they in this kind of sense, you know, and less about my image of who I want my kids to be, but who, what already has them. And yes, they're with me. So there's no getting out of my influences and my biases, but parenting is another like area. But if we don't really couple with this ethos, it's going to be really hard to parent from this ethos. You know?
Maybe a new dating app.
New dating app.
What archetypes are you claimed by? We'll match them up.
Totally. Yeah.
Hey, well, thank you, Rob. This has been a fantastic conversation, and I'd love to have you back on. I feel like we just scratched the surface of a lot of it.
Totally. That was like one of the vectors. Yeah. One of the other vectors. We'll have to tangle some other ones later. Hey, yeah, total pleasure and lots of love to you, and stay safe. And I look forward to next time, and let me know if I can do anything for you or what you guys are up to at the Monastic Canada.